I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man, I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man, I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man, I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa.
Good afternoon, Vashon Island. This is Megan Hastings with the Cats and Jammer Follies on Voice of Vashon. And this week, we have Dan Chasen, a dear friend to both my husband and I. He is a longtime Islander, was on the school board for many a years, a journalist, and an avid traveler. And he is here to tell us a few stories of his past travels. One is set in Afghanistan in 1967, and the following one in Mexico in 1962. Dan, welcome to the show. How are you?
Pretty good, Megan. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for coming on.
You're welcome.
So his first story that he's going to tell, again, is set in Afghanistan, and it's beautifully written and completely crazy interesting. So get ready, buckle up, Dan.
We were stuck in Kabul. Forget the old Creedence Clearwater Revival line. Oh Lord, stuck in Lodi again. This was worse. The city hadn't yet been shattered by decades of war and terrorism. You still saw pictures of the balding king on the currency, in public buildings, everywhere. It was the dead of winter. Kabul sits at almost 6,000 feet. It was cold. We saw snow on the mountains, smelled wood smoke, smelled hashish, saw black embassy cars with little flags on their fenders, big old brightly painted trucks, virtually no other traffic, except ragged hazaras from the central mountains, pulling huge wooden carts piled high with cauliflower. Tall, turbaned tribesmen swaggered down sidewalks, stepping aside for no one. In doorways, people wrapped themselves in old bedspreads and tablecloths to keep warm. We'd just gotten married. We'd been living in Manhattan. We'd both had great jobs. We'd saved some money. We left our jobs, boarded a Greek freighter in Brooklyn, headed out. I was going to do some journalism. We were going to see some sights. We didn't know when we'd be back. We made an unscheduled stop in Tripoli, where we visited the camel market. A guy we met on the street not only told us how to get there, he gave us bus fare. Disembarked at Piraeus. We spent a couple of nights in Athens, one in Delphi, flew to Istanbul. We visited the famous mosques and the great Byzantine dome of Hagia Sophia, got bombarded with rocks and fruit in a waterfront neighborhood. On the southern coast, we swam, visited ruins, hung out with a young clarinet player and his wife, a belly dancer, went to a small town for a grease wrestling tournament. We rode buses through villages where men sat in coffee shops, smoking water pipes while women worked in the fields. From Erzurum in eastern Turkey, we caught a bus to Tehran. We found a big, chilly city, wide streets with no stoplights and scary traffic, old posters of the Shah on blank walls. We ate well, Iranian horeshts and kebabs with big mounds of rice, blini caviar at a white Russian restaurant, great yogurt from a neighborhood store, fresh pomegranate juice from ubiquitous storefront stands. In Shiraz, where we went for the ruins of Persepolis, we found a restaurant with great food, but stains on the wall so disgusting that Barbara had to look straight ahead. Back in Tehran, we went to a cocktail party at the U.S. Embassy, stayed late talking with the ambassador and the writer Wallace Stegner. We ate caviar at the Russian restaurant for Thanksgiving, then boarded an Iran Air jet for Kabul. We watched the sunrise over the northern mountains, watched a brown landscape below us, felt the plane starting down. The pilot announced that since the weather had been too bad for anyone to land at Kabul for days, we were heading for Kandahar. Our arrival was surreal. We walked to a big modern terminal that was totally empty. There were airline desks with no one behind them, alcoves for shops that weren't there. No one flew to Kandahar. The USSR had built an airport in Kabul. Not to be outdone, we had built one in Kandahar. The fact that no one flew there didn't matter. An old American school bus appeared. It would take us to Kabul. There was no heat, but there were blankets. Before we left, though, the blankets were removed for a long ride through the mountains in December. Off we went. It got dark. It got colder. People lent each other warm clothes. We were in the month of Ramadan. The driver hadn't eaten all day. At one point, the bus started sliding off the road, tilted onto two wheels, before our driver steadied it and got us back on the highway. We came over the pass, and there at last were the lights of Kabul. We'd made it. I bought Barbara a very old pin with a verse from the Quran engraved in lapis lazuli. On New Year's Eve, we sat on our hotel balcony drinking Iranian vodka mixed with the juice of Pakistani oranges. A British air crew there on a temp assignment was staying at our hotel. The bad weather that had forced us to Kandahar had hung around. The Brits weren't flying. Neither was much of anyone else except the Afghans. The Afghan airline kept flying in and out. A guest at the hotel suggested the Afghans were just reckless. Maybe, the British captain said, or maybe they're just really good pilots. A woman we had met on the bus invited us to dinner at her hotel. The hotel manager invited us up to a private room to hear a recital of traditional music on traditional instruments. The music was extraordinary. Afterward, we went back downstairs to get our coats. Barbara's coat had contained our passports and half our traveler's checks. They were gone. No one owned a cell phone in those days. Virtually no one took credit cards. We could phone the United States, but only in a time slot after midnight. We were on our own. First step was getting new passports. That was pretty straightforward. At least it would have been if Christmas hadn't intervened and the U.S. consulate been closed. With the consulate open, we got the passports without a lot of fuss. That was just the first step. Passports wouldn't get us out of the country. We'd need Afghan exit visas, too. That was easier said than done, and not just because Afghan government offices were closed for Eid, the Muslim holiday at the end of Ramadan. We went to one government office after another. The people in one office would send us on to the next. Finally, well back in a warren of offices, we came to a small room in which a hip young military officer in dark glasses was reading French movie magazines. He wasn't encouraging. I tried to pull a few strings. At the Tehran embassy party, we'd met the U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan. I called him. He said he'd find out what to do. He gave me an address. Finally, we knew where to go. When we got to the building, it looked vaguely familiar. It contained the usual people wrapped in whatever they could find. We went to the right office, where we found the same young officer in dark glasses. We were right back where we'd started. We had no quick way out. Before they'd let us leave the country, we had to prove we had legally entered. Normally, there would have been a record of our arrival at Kabul, but we hadn't flown to Kabul. And since virtually no one ever flew to Kandahar, no one there kept records. We'd have to get a copy of the official passenger list, which the airline had at its headquarters in Tehran. They finally sent us the list, but it took time. We'd been at this for weeks. At last, we could leave. We boarded an old British bus and rolled out through a fog that had coated all the trees in ice. It was beautiful. The bus rolled into a gorge. The green Kabul River foamed far below. Husks of wrecked trucks littered the slope. It wasn't hard to see how the British Army retreating from Kabul in 1842 might have been easy prey for tribal forces in these mountains. Of 16,000 people who left Kabul, most of them Indian troops, dependent civilians, only one European, a military surgeon, and a handful of Indians made it down to Jalalabad on the plain. We made it to Jalalabad ourselves, where we found lightly dressed men leading donkeys laden with sugar cane. At the Pakistani border, in a big open room, we saw a tough-looking guy with a rifle, leading a file of other men, handcuffed together. Someone explained that the handcuffed men were Afghan tribesmen, whose flocks had had little to eat in the winter mountains, so they'd driven the animals down to better pasture in Pakistan, as their tribe had been doing forever. These days, the Pakistanis didn't like it and were shipping them back. Whenever I read about the porous border between Afghanistan and Pakistan, I think of those men. Then we were winding through the Khyber Pass with its fortified hilltops and long history, and finally we were rolling into Peshawar. We had a detached cabin there. A fire burned in the fireplace. Sick with chills and fever, I crawled under the covers and stayed there until dinner. I may have felt like crap, but we were finally out. It could all have been worse. In Kabul, we had hung out with an Afghan doctor and his Scandinavian wife. They lived with his family. Much later, we heard that she had had enough and wanted to leave. She couldn't leave the country legally without his permission. He was away. He couldn't give it. She knew people at the U.S. Embassy, though, who had a car with diplomatic plates. It wouldn't be searched at the border. They stashed her in the trunk and drove her to Pakistan. We had had it relatively easy. Tomorrow we'd reach Lahore, then we'd catch a train to Delhi, fly to Madras, and eventually Colombo, where we'd spend a month with my aunt and uncle. In less than a week, we'd be eating ripe papaya in Sri Lanka. We were on our way.
تو از کدوم قصه ای که خواستنت عادت نبودنت فاجعه بودنت امنیت تو از کدوم سرزمین تو از کدوم هوایی که از قبیله من یه آسمون جدایی اهل هر جا که باشی قاصد شکفتنی توی بهد و دقدقه ناجی قلب منی
Dan, thank you for sharing that story with us. It's a really fascinating adventure that you and Barbara took during that time. It's amazing that you even got to do that. I have, of course, many questions for you. Well, first off, can you, I mean, we all want to take trips and be adventurous, but Afghanistan and Iran in winter 1967, what brought you there in the first place? Like, what was the attraction to there?
Well, that part of the world had interested me.
Yeah.
And I had figured out a couple of stories to do.
And you were, as we know, a journalist, but who were you working for at that time?
I was on the staff of the New Yorker at that time.
Okay.
And I took a leave, but got assignments for a couple of stories, which actually they bought but never published.
Oh, well, as long as you got the money. No, I'm just kidding. But what were the stories? Were they...
It was political stuff, really.
Yeah.
And the stuff I did in Kabul was getting some sense of the country, but also talking about the politics. And, you know, it was obvious at that time that the government, that the society that existed then was going to fall apart. Just nobody knew exactly when or how.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a little bit. You and I touched base on this about the Russian invasion happening. What it would probably be like 10 years later.
Yeah, a dozen years afterward.
Yeah. Can you just explain to me, just explain for people that don't know what the difference would have been before compared to like what it is now?
Well, Afghanistan has passed through a number of sort of unfortunate stages. And
many, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, to say the least.
When we were there, it was a monarchy, but there was there was an elected parliament with limited power, I think.
But it was more progressive.
In some ways, at least it had been some years before the law had changed so that women could go on the streets without veils.
Mm-hmm.
Although we were told that in Kandahar in the south, which was the birthplace of the Taliban, the mullahs were really conservative. And if they found a woman walking on the street without a veil, they'd throw acid in her face.
So
it was progressive in some ways,
yeah,
but
very not in other ways.
Not in others. And the literacy rate was very low. And if somebody left the country to get advanced training or education, he'd come back and find very little to do.
And where would a lot of people from like Afghanistan or Iran go for education? I know that many people emigrated to France and to Los Angeles. In fact, when I lived in Los Angeles, I worked in the garment industry, and so much of that industry is run by Persian people who came after the Shah,
after the Iranian Revolution.
After the Iranian Revolution in 1979.
Which was right about the time when the Russians went into Afghanistan, of course. I mean, I don't really know where people tended to go. We met a doctor in Kabul who had gone for advanced cardiology training in Canada.
Right.
I used to have a brother-in-law who was Iranian, who had been sent out of the country to a boarding school in England when he was about 12, and I don't think he'd ever been back to Iran. Then he'd gone to college in the United States and was a professor at a college in Los Angeles, also a real estate speculator.
There's actually an area in Los Angeles that is so profoundly Iranian that it's called Tarangelis, which I love to go to those kinds of areas and cities. I miss that, actually. It's the one thing that I miss a lot being in a small community, is that you can't stumble into the Russian neighborhood and, you know, find Vereniki or whatever. You know what I mean? It's not like these big places with pockets of different cultures. But, I mean, we have our own very different, interesting cultures here.
We do. But it's not the same thing. No, I used to have a friend in college who was fluent in about five languages, who would just find the ethnic neighborhoods and cities so he could keep in practice.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's fun. I had a couple other questions. So you were talking about having Iranian vodka and Pakistan orange juice, or oranges, fresh oranges. And of course, that brings up all the beautiful flavors of that area and that region of the world. Will you tell us about some of the things that you tasted? It's an area that I really aspire to go to one day, and I just, politically, it just seems like it'll never happen in my lifetime, but
yeah, I find it hard to imagine going back there. Well, you know, the food we found in Afghanistan, although not at private houses, was pretty basic. You know, there was a lot of lamb and cauliflower, also a lot of cauliflower and lamb, and
and then fried cauliflower and boiled lamb.
Yeah. In Iran, of course, that's a very sophisticated cuisine, and it was easy to eat well in restaurants.
All right, so that is going to lead us into your next story, Dan. So this is set a little... What age were you when you and Barbara were in Afghanistan?
I was early 20s. She was late 20s. I guess maybe she just turned 30.
Okay, so we are going to go a bunch of years earlier than that, when you would have been pretty young.
I was 18.
Yeah. In Mexico. All right, Dan, please give us your next story.
If I did it, my father said, he'd never speak to me again. He was trying to keep me from spending the summer after my first year of college at my uncle's house in Mexico City, then traveling a bit by myself. I ignored him, as a few years later, I ignored him when he said the same thing about my leaving the East Coast for Seattle. I think he was just scared. I went. My plane landed in Mexico City after dark. As soon as I got to the terminal, I called my uncle. "Didn't you get my telegram?" he asked. One or both of his kids was seriously ill and maybe contagious, and he'd told me not to come. But I hadn't gotten the message, and here I was. I took a taxi to his house. My cousins recovered. They and my aunt went to visit her family in Philadelphia. My uncle and I were alone in the house. He was a vegetarian. From the time he was very young, he couldn't stand the idea of eating something that looked like it had been alive. It looked to him like it had been alive. He liked to walk, although he hadn't done much of it lately and had grown pretty stout. One weekend, he had someone drop us at a neighborhood across the city from his house so we could take a long walk home. On the way, we stopped by a market. He bought a pound of hamburger. I thought this was odd. When we got home, we went into the kitchen where he put the meat on a table. We stayed in the kitchen and talked. While we did, I watched him devour a whole pound of raw hamburger. He started to paint my portrait. He had gone to art school, taught art at a college. After World War II, he had started working for CARE, first feeding people in Europe, then all over the world. Now he was in charge of the CARE mission in Mexico, but he'd kept painting. No one would sit for him, so he was accumulating one of the world's great collections of self-portraits. He was glad I was willing to sit. but he went off to join his family in Philadelphia before he finished the painting. He left me alone in the Churubusco neighborhood. When I walked on our side street, I'd pass a high white wall covered with purple bougainvillea. Often, if I didn't have anywhere specific to go, I'd walk to Coyoacan, passing the house in which Leon Trotsky had been assassinated, and winding up at Frida Kahlo's old house, now a museum. Back in New York, I soon got to know my father's friend, the Catalan painter José Bartoli, who in the late 1940s had been Kahlo's lover. 5 years ago, a New York gallery displayed her love letters to him, then auctioned them off for $137,000. Another walk took me by vacant land on which people had built hovels of scrap metal and cardboard. Before Mexico, I'd never seen poverty like that. At the university, I met some Mexican guys my age. The next day, we went out to a town in the mountains to play soccer against a local team on a lumpy field with a pig tethered on the sideline. We ate lunch at a roadside restaurant, ran races in the road, got back to Mexico City in time for a soccer game at the National Stadium. They all wanted to know what I thought about the Chamizal. This was a dispute dating to the 19th century over land that had been Mexican but had wound up on the American side of the Rio Grande after the river changed course. The issue was finally settled a couple of years later. I'd been the best history student in my high school class. I'd read the New York Times for years. I was an editor of an inter-American student magazine. I thought I was well informed. I'd never heard of the Chamizal. So important to them, so invisible to me. That was an eye-opener. I took an overnight bus to Oaxaca with barnyard fowl in the luggage racks. In the morning, I took a taxi to the ruins of Monte Albán, where I spent the day. That night, I went to Coatzacoalcos, by a river on the steamy Gulf Coast. From the other side of the river, I'd be able to catch a train through the jungle to Palenque, where I wanted to see the great Mayan ruins. The next day, heavy rain swelled the river, and its brown water carried big logs downstream. I had to take a bus across the river to catch the train, which moved very slowly through the jungle. I arrived in Palenque the next day. It was a very small place then, and accommodations were pretty basic. I got a room in a round hotel with a conical sheet metal roof. When rain thundered down, being in that building felt like being inside a drum. I went out to the ruins. There was basically no one else there. A small group of Mexicans visited briefly. A trio of Americans came. One of them knew my uncle from the 1940s. That was pretty well it. When I took a break from the ruins, I chatted with the guard. That night, I was going to take a late train out of town. I'd go to Villahermosa, then fly to Mérida in the Yucatan, where I had an appointment to meet my mother in a specific hotel bar at a specific time. We'd decided to hang out together and celebrate my birthday before flying home. Before I left, I decided to go out and see the town. Night had fallen. The hotel owner had strapped on a pistol. I walked out into the dark streets. There were a few lights, but they weren't real street lights, just bare bulbs. The streets weren't paved. There were deep ruts. Lots of men were milling around in the near dark. Almost all of them wore pistols. This made me a little nervous. After a while, I ran into the guard from the ruins who was walking with a friend. They invited me to go have a beer with them. We went into a bar. The friend had just gotten back from Monterrey, where he'd gone to make some money. He was glad to be back. He hadn't much cared for the big city. I still hadn't quite forgotten this dark street full of armed men. Yes, he said, it was such a relief to be back in Palenque, where he felt safe. I realized it was all a matter of what you were used to. I flew into Mérida, took a cab to the hotel. I walked into the bar, which was on a patio overlooking a pool. My mother was there. I wasn't surprised that she was traveling alone. She and my father had stayed together for 20 years and had a lot in common. But he'd stepped over an emotional line years before, and their marriage had no real core. They never traveled together. In Mexico City, I'd felt some heart palpitations. My uncle had given me the name of a doctor. The doctor had prescribed me some heart medication, which didn't seem to do me any harm, and told me to drink no more than one beer a day, which probably did me some good. There was really nothing wrong with me. Anyway, when I met my mother at the bar, it was time for me to take a pill. She hadn't known about the heart stuff. I said, "There's something I should tell you," and explained. After I finished, she said, "And there's something I should tell you. On my way down here, I stopped in Ciudad Juarez and got divorced. What the hell? We had our drink. On my birthday, we went out to the ruins at Uxmal, largely deserted on a day as gray like the stone. When I got back to the U.S., my father had already moved to the apartment where he'd live until his final stroke. And in his closet, he no doubt already stashed the big cardboard box full of letters he and my mother had exchanged when he was away in World War II, back before things went bad.
Fiesta la llevo a bailar. Sus piernas flacas se parecen quebrar. Oh, potito no es un primor, pero baila que da pavor. A mi popotito yo le di mi amor.
Dan, thank you. That was a beautiful story. I, of course, have some questions for you about that one, too.
Of course.
Of course. That's what we're here for. So was this uncle living in Mexico, the same uncle that you talked about, who you would later go see in India?
In Sri Lanka, yes.
In Sri Lanka,
yes, he's the same guy. He lived all over the world for many years.
And so you talked just for a moment about the CARE mission, and can you please go into more detail about what that was and how that brought him around the world?
It was formed after World War II, I think largely by people who'd been conscientious objectors during the war, as he had been. He wasn't a Quaker, but he was married to a Quaker, and he was a CO. And it was, I think, formed primarily to feed and get other supplies to the people in Europe who were in terrible shape after the war. And so he first, well, he traveled around setting up some care missions, I think. And then he was living in Helsinki, doing things for people in Scandinavia. And then he was in Rome, where I also visited him. And then I was a kid, doing things in
which
Italy.
Which needed a lot of help after
needed
World
a lot
War
of help.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they had expanded, or they did expand their focus. And so he was in Hong Kong and India, Sri Lanka, where I visited him, and then he was in South America before he retired.
And how long was he in Mexico for?
Several years.
Is it still an organization that's still...
Yeah, as far as I know.
Oh, interesting.
Several years ago in Seattle at some kind of a party, I ran into a guy who had succeeded him in Sri Lanka.
Wow, really?
Yes.
That's random.
Very random.
That must have been quite a upsetting situation for you as a young man to hear that so far away from home, so far away from your dad, and to hear that your mom had just stopped and gotten a divorce from him.
Well, it was pretty out of the blue.
Pretty out of the blue. And you didn't, I mean, you knew that they weren't like madly in love, but you had, you know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah. 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 Gotta love life, don't you? I want to ask about Chamazal for a minute. And can you please expel on that more? Because it's something that I have never heard of either.
Yeah, it's...
And probably most people.
Most people never heard of it. And well, it was, you know, it was resolved.
Yeah.
You know, long ago.
But
even at the time, virtually no one in this country had heard of it.
That's what I mean.
And yeah.
Yeah. But in Mexico, it was still...
At least among people
really,
at the university.
Yeah.
It was a big deal.
Yeah.
And I think around that time, the Kennedy administration did engage with Mexico and did work things out. And then I think in about 64, Congress approved a treaty and it was all settled, some sort of, you know, splitting the difference.
It's interesting how America chooses its own history and what we as its own citizens learn or don't learn.
And how ignorant we are.
Yeah.
And how, I mean, what this brought home to me was how oblivious we could be to things that are so important to people elsewhere.
Yeah, exactly. I have a couple other questions. I want to hear just a little bit more about Frida Kahlo's lover. What was his name again?
Jose Bartoli.
And do you know his artwork? I don't know his work.
I have a number of his paintings.
Oh,
I can show you.
Oh, I do want to see that. Is it, what kind of artwork is it?
The stuff that I have is, it's all figurative.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it's kind of expressionist, but not much of it.
That's really amazing that you got to hang out with him.
He was an interesting guy.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Because he was part of this.
You'd have to be some kind of interesting to catch the attention of Frida Kahlo.
Well, I think so. I think so. And, you know, she was married to Diego Rivera, whom Bartley also knew. It was known that she'd had a whole bunch of lovers. But evidently in her letters to Bartley, she said she'd be willing to leave Rivera for him.
Wow, really?
Oh, she didn't. Then,
well, but he was no prize the way he treated her. So I
probably not. But, you know, but there was this whole sort of Spanish artistic diaspora, people who had gotten out who didn't want to be in Spain with
yeah,
Franco there. So,
sure.
So Bartley knew these people all over. Like periodically he'd say he'd be gone for a couple of weeks. He was going to go to Mexico and hang out with Luis Buñuel.
I love those art scenes. Everyone's smoking cigarettes, drinking strong coffee.
Yeah, right.
With berets. And then, of course, the last thing that everybody wants to know is where are the love letters between your parents?
In a closet in my house. I've got them. I've got them. I hadn't known they existed until my father had had this last stroke and was in hospitals and nursing homes. And I was cleaning out his apartment because he was obviously never going back. And stuffed way back in a closet, there was this box. And I opened it and there were these letters. I had never known they existed.
Have you actually read all of them?
I'm not sure I've read all of them. They're a lot. And some of them are just, you know, sort of chatting.
How are you
things.
Doing?
Yeah. But some of them were really
fascinating.
Really something. Yeah.
Oh. Well, there was love, true love at one point.
And well, there was.
Very good to know.
I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Crossed the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Louisville, Nashville, Knoxville, Ombabaka, Shepherdville, Jacksonville, Waterville, Costa Rica, Pittsfield.
Thank you very much for tuning in. This is Megan Hastings with the Cats and Jammer Follies. And I want to thank Dan Chasen for joining me today on the show and Voice of Vashon for having me here every week. And please come back and join us for another crazy travel story. Who knows where we're going to go next time? It's a big world out there. Thank you.
I've been to Pittsburgh, Parkersburg, Gravelburg, Colorado, Ellensburg, Rexburg, Vicksburg, Eldorado, Laramore.